Welcome to Worlds Apart. The American expression of wanting to have a cake and eat it too describes the typical neurotic conflict of pursuing the irreconcilable that seems to be behind a lot of geopolitics these days. Nobody likes the Trump administration's tariffs or the unbounded Israeli aggression, but doing anything meaningful to resist them seems like too high of an order. Is it possible to arrive at a fair system without sacrificing some of the boons of the old one? Well, to discuss that, I'm now joined by Richard Sakwa, Professor Emeritus at the University of Kent and author of Lost Peace, How the West Failed to Prevent a Second Cold War. Professor Sakwa, it's always a pleasure and a great honor for me to talk to you. Thank you very much for being here.
Likewise, it's always good to talk with you.
Thank you. Now, we are recording this interview on the sidelines of the Valdai Discussion Club, which loves to talk about multipolarity. I wonder, though, if the contours of multipolarity, as you saw them, let's say, a year ago, remain the same.
Well, I think that one of the difficulties always is the failure to define what we mean by multipolarity. I argue that there's several levels to it. At the first and most important one, I argue that the international system established in 1945 with the United Nations, with all the program of decolonization, has led today to a world of 193 sovereign states represented in the United Nations. We're meeting at a time when the General Assembly is meeting. That is a fundamental normative legal multipolarity, and we shouldn't forget that. So in other words, states, large, small, medium, are all in legal terms equal in this system. And that's something new, by the way. And so we tend to forget that. The second level is a classic American multipolarity, Kenneth Waltz, where it's all about power, military, and so on. This would be the classical realist view. Now, I mean, we and some of us at this discussion club, we could call ourselves soft realists. And this is a third vision of multipolarity, which is to say, yes, we're realists. We understand that the world is effectively a global anarchy, but that does not mean chaos. It means that there are organizations. And the third level of meaning of multipolarity would be a genuine sense that the balance of power, the balance of influence, and sort of the structural terms, economic shift from the Atlantic basin to the Pacific. It means that power, influence, economy, cultural influence is spread more widespread now.
Now, speaking about this third definition, I don't know if you would agree with that, but I think until recently there was sort of a tacit assumption among middle and small-sized nations that they would be delivered smoothly into the multipolar world by the great power rivalry, that they can sort of hedge their interests safely while sitting on the fence. Do you think that's still the case?
The idea of bandwagoning, you have the big one and you just follow them behind it. Yes. No. In other words, that I believe that you have to have a more active implementation and vision of a genuine, multipolarity. But, multipolarity has to be accompanied by a second concept, and that is a multi-order world. A lot of people have written about it, Amitava Acharya and all the rest. The idea is that, and I've been arguing this, I mean, I don't want to have a long history, but just very briefly, after 1945, you had two major visions of world order. You had the Soviet one, the Soviet-led bloc, that collapsed in the late 1980s. The second one is what the Russians love to call the collective West. I call it the political West, this Atlantic power system led by Washington, including Europe, allies, South Korea, Japan, etc. This second world order, the political West, is now being challenged by a nascent vision of a multi-order. I don't know what to call it. No one does. Let's call it, for convenience, the political East, Russia, China, an alignment. It's not intending to change the international system, the UN system, but precisely the opposite, to make it work better so that the multipolarity of sovereign internationalism represented by the United Nations actually works.
Now, this is a fascinating idea, and some would argue long overdue, but I think the hardest part is, as usual, the delivery, the steps that should be taken in order to realize this grand notion. And I think right now it's pretty clear that either in the case with the Trump administration tariffs or with the Israeli strikes on Gaza or on Qatar, It affected many nations. Many are very unhappy about it, but they sort of face this very interesting dilemma, either to protest it, you know, forthrightly and draw the wrath of Washington, or essentially tacitly go along with it and try to negotiate some concessions or discounts behind closed doors. And most nations, even such giants as India, I think are trying the second route. Mm. Do you think that's an effective strategy of arriving to a point where we are all equal, not only in, you know, in the words of the chapter, but at least we can count on some international legal framework to protect some basis of interaction?
Yeah, I mean, India traditionally has, you know, what's called multi-vectorism.
What's called? I think called is the key word here.
Rather than actually. Well, it was. I mean, India has had an independent foreign policy since it was established as an independent state, but with obviously a long-term relationship with the Soviet Union and today Russia, which it is not repudiating, despite the pressure. So I don't entirely agree with you. I think that India, for example, it's not just hedging anymore. It's the fact that it went to the Tianjin Shanghai Cooperation Organization meeting quite, you know, explicitly after Trump had put the extra 25% tariffs on oil, which makes it 50%, which is quite devastating in all sorts of ways. So what people are now saying is that the United States is repudiating the very economic system that it was one of the leaders and founders of after the Second World War. And they're saying, if you're going to destroy it, I mean, I don't like the word globalization, but in a sense that we have to now establish not alternatives, because the United States and the West is still hugely powerful, but they will not be intimidated. In other words, India is maintaining its independence. And, you know, I think it is beginning to step up to the plate, which I think you're saying, of global leadership. India, China, Russia, this sort of alignment. Can I just stress one thing? This is not an anti-Western alignment. It's a post-Western alignment. And that's a fundamental difference. So it's not anti Western because the power of the dollar has not disappeared, which is the implication of what you're saying. The United States is a huge economy, and European Union and allies. So, but in a sense, we have to maybe achieve what you began with. We began with multipolarity, establishing our own framework within the framework of the United Nations, the international system.
Now, Professor Sakwa, I think we are yet to see what the Indian talks at Washington will produce, because sure, the Indians are, you know, talking very loudly about their independence, but there are various leaked reports about how flexible or amenable they are to the American pressure. Nevertheless, I agree with you that at least in the fact that India is a major trendsetter or trailblazer for other nations, and the outcome of their discussions will set the tone for other countries, which leads me to a next question. Why do you think we have seen so little collective action against Washington so far? Because as you said, Washington can be pretty intimidating when faced one-on-one, but it's not without, its power is not without its limits.
You're absolutely right. This idea, you mentioned, you know, have your cake and eat it at the beginning. And of course, Boris Johnson loved this cakeism. And I think everybody is a cakeist at heart. They want to have it both ways. But what you're suggesting is they're talking the talk and not walking the walk. I'm not sure that in a country like India, they don't want to commit economic or even, you know, suicide effectively, because the United States and the West, of course, it's, you know, you could call a strategy of hedging and balancing and under the present Trump system, that this room for maneuver is more limited. So this is early days.
Is that necessarily a bad thing, though, when the room for maneuver is limited? Wouldn't that lead countries to perhaps finally take a principled position on some of the issues they like paying lip service to?
Or vice versa. You actually have to succumb and accept the real, you know, who actually has the big stick at the moment. I think that everybody across the world at the moment is not quite sure how to react. So this is effectively, you know, relatively early days, eight months into this extraordinary new arrangement. I mean, a good example is the European Union, which basically keeled over and accepted the US conditions without any reservations. India has been fighting back. China, of course, has got the power and the clout to do so.
And some skin in the game as well. Now, there's an interesting dimension to the Trump administration tariffs policy. I'm talking about the so-called transshipment policies, which essentially aim at the goods that have a large part or large portion of foreign components. And mainly it's China that trades a lot in components. So with this kind of policy, many experts at least believe that the Trump administration is aiming at the core of globalization as we knew it, and perhaps trying to redesign or destroy the remaining transnational supply chains. And yet I heard you call the Trump administration policies globalism. You say that it's not liberal globalism, but imperial globalism. What's the difference?
It's a huge difference in the sense that after 1945, the United States led this political West, and it had two facets. It had a commonwealth, a public good, establishing relatively free trade and so on. The other side was the imperial element. What Trump has done, he's cast aside the veil, he's torn the curtain, and he's said, look, this is imperial globalism. So what we had before was liberal globalism, obviously. But it's important to stress, liberal globalism is not the same as the sovereign internationalism embedded in the Charter International System. So there's been a tension right at the beginning. But the United States, indeed, could have it both ways until recently. Trump has decided that they can no longer have it. And don't forget, Biden effectively continued that same policy from Trump's first administration. So there's a change going on. But liberal globalism is when the United States wants to assert its power again without taking into account even the needs of its allies in Europe and Japan and elsewhere, and of course China, which has worked with it economically for a long time. So it's a new ball game, which is, by the way, criticized very much within the United States by people in MAGA itself, Make America Great Again, American Firstness, who says we don't even need this liberal imperialism. We need a genuine focus on developing the United States.
Well, despite all the criticism, the Trump administration is not budging, at least not now. But I heard some experts suggest that these blunt policies of President Trump may lead China to revisit some of its policies and approaches, for example, in the South China Sea, simply because at this point of time, it needs more goodwill from its neighbors and partners across the world. Do you think that's likely that the Trump administration will lead China to perhaps take an advantage of the chaos that has been sown?
Well, in some ways, already China is taking a more active lead. It helped broker, let's call it peace, but, some sort of concord between Saudi Arabia and Iran. That was a major diplomatic initiative. And, of course, we've got the BRICS grouping, which has now been expanded, which is a coalition, an alignment of like-minded people in which China takes a leading role. The Global Governance Initiative, I think, was very important just recently. So, yes, China is stepping up to the plate, but it is not doing so in a confrontational manner. And that perhaps leads many people to be more frustrated. Why aren't you being more active? Why aren't you really taking on and challenging this sort of bullying behavior, if you could call it, from the United States? But that would run counter to the very idea of this win-win situation, community of common values, common purpose, and so on in China's ideology. Because it's not, as I say, it's not counter-hegemonic, in a sense, just simply playing the same game from the other side. It's actually trying to change the rules of the game itself by saying, look, we need to go back to the charter principles and comity, amity, states working together for the common good, unlike the Western powers.
Well, I've heard from some of the Chinese neighbors that sometimes China, too, can behave pretty much like the Trump administration on issues that are very sensitive to its heart. But for the time being, let's take a very short break. We will be back in just a few moments. Stay tuned. Welcome back to Worlds Apart with Richard Sakwa, Professor Emeritus at the University of Kent and author of Lost Peace, How the West Failed to Prevent a Second Cold War. Professor Sakwa, as the subtitle of your book asserts, the West failed to prevent another round of confrontation with Russia. I wonder, though, if it indeed failed, or rather actively sought to use this deterioration of relationship, you know, for its own strategic reasons.
Absolutely. So it was rather a softer version of what we could say is that it's not just failed to do it, but
aimed to fail.
Maybe it was intended to do so, to ensure that the what we were discussing as a political West remained dominant and hegemonic. If you remember, the Wolfowitz doctrine of 1992 was, you know, it evoked much criticism in the early 90s. Yet basically this idea that the United States has to remain the top power, no other power can challenge it, and so on. And unfortunately, in the European context, it had huge negative consequences. It's not just simply NATO enlargement. It's the way it was done, which was not taken into account, because even Zbigniew Brzezinski, a passionate advocate of NATO enlargement, said, of course, we need to have a larger agreement with Russia. They failed to do that. And so it's worse than a Cold War, of course, as we see now.
Now, before the break, we talked about how non-Western countries are adjusting to Trump's economic and political pressures. And I want to ask you about the stance of the so-called American allies in Europe. Putting aside all this big daddy fawning, do you think the European strategy of leveraging Trump is effective?
Well, it's I wouldn't call it leveraging so much as bandwagoning, in the sense that it has not put up any resistance in terms of tariffs. We saw that they accepted the 15% tariffs without quibbling, questioning it. But the larger question is, what happens now? Because what's the larger issue is, a fascinating one, is that if we're going to accept that there was this transatlantic alliance system, that there was this political West, collective West, call it what you like, after the Second World War, it is now dissolving into its component parts. We're seeing an Atlantic divide. So what does Europe do now? Where does it go? I mean, not just economically, obviously the United States is a major economic partner, but how can it devise its own strategy at a time of conflict in our continent? And since the idea of the Gorbachevian ideas, which we've sometimes talked about 40 years ago, common European home, is clearly not on the agenda at the moment. What is also more frightening is that the continent seems to be seized by war fever, this extraordinary fevered idea that we're going to be in permanent conflict with Russia. We have to intensify it, deepen it, and make it worse.
Well, let's talk about that, because some experts suggested that the key European objective now is to keep the Americans in, both as security and collective action provider, and to put off for as long as possible solving, or at least dealing with, the EU's own structural and strategic problems. Do you agree with that? And do you think that quote-unquote strategy or that approach has any expiration date?
Many people argue, in counter to that, that that particular idea to remain wedded to the vision of the United States as a security provider, and more than that, the political leader of this political West, is pursuing a policy that has already achieved its sell-by date, as we'd say, its expiry date, and it's time to devise a new strategy. And the utter failure to do so is only intensifying the pain which is going to come.
But why would they need that? Because, I mean, you know better than anyone else that on a structural level, the EU is facing a multiplicity of economic, political, collective action, what have you, problems. And, you know, doing that requires not only some political will, but also, you know, basic skills of governing. And they don't seem to be so much on offer.
They're totally absent, I think, in terms of leadership, statecraft.
So isn't that a better option in the absence of anything else?
Well, for example, the Rearm Europe, you know, this plan to spend 5% of countries' GDP on arms. In other words, this is a type of, to get out of the difficulties you mentioned, which are deeply economic. The Draghi report of just over a year ago, which talked about the fundamental lack of competitiveness of the European economy, is an attempt to, in part, to solve it by demilitarization, which is the classic way. But of course, that doesn't solve any of the domestic problems, and it doesn't solve the challenge represented by right and left populism, which are precisely protests against the failure to achieve, to deliver public goods.
Now, to some extent, Russia has also used it's a security issue or security problems as a way to modernize itself. And its economy has adjusted to the crisis in Ukraine. It's built up military production. It also led to a certain development of technology. I think also in social sphere, in public infrastructure, the Russian government is investing a lot to make sure that, you know, the people's attitudes remain smooth. And I wonder if the EU could be served from learning from Russia's experience of adjusting to the Ukrainian crisis. Could it get some ideas for its own development there?
It would never acknowledge it, but perhaps in de facto it does a similar sort of military Keynesianism, that is, spending on military. But in Russia and elsewhere, I would always argue that that's a short term. Obviously, Russia is facing fundamental challenges and it's dealt with them. I mean, I'm talking about financial stability, economic investment, and so on, relatively well, because at the same time, it's not just fighting a conflict, it's also investing, as you say, in infrastructure. The plan just announced not long ago by the Prime Minister, Mikhail Mishustin, to build a network of high-speed railways. All of this is a sign that Russia isn't just fighting a conflict, it's also developing internally. But of course, there will be problems of technological and other stagnation. And there will be the fundamental problem of readjusting and retooling the economy to shift from a military stance to a domestic technological and other development. For example, even as we speak, the Financial Times argues that Russia has missed out entirely on the boom of artificial intelligence, for example.
Really?
But meantime, even as we meet here at the Valdai Club, a session on technological development is showing that in certain respects, Russia is still moving forward.
Russia had a sort of and had warning before the rest of the world of trying to be more self-sufficient and less reliant on the globalized infrastructure. And to some extent, the Western aggression or Western confrontation with Russia helped it a lot to deal with the current times, because I think at this point of time, it's easier for the Russians to adjust and to find new routes for their trade. I wonder if Russian experience could be helpful to the rest of the world in how to find ways of navigating this very difficult currents of global politics.
And that's a fascinating question, because Russia has, at least for two decades, been pursuing a policy of technological sovereignty, of more broadly, an industrial strategy where foreign companies have to have localization of production and so on. And as you say, the rest of the world now seems to be following, including the United States, the Biden Inflation Reduction Act and so on. So yes, we're talking about a new epoch of industrial and focus on investment. Just to say, put it into perspective, the first 40 years after the Second World War was, you know, building social democratic states, welfare states. The last 40 years have been devoted to demolishing the social welfare states, including industrial policy. And we are now entering a new age, a new epoch. And Russia is one of the leaders in that, because it's quite clearly adjusted and its economy is handling and coping reasonably well in very challenging circumstances.
Now, when President Putin was meeting with President Trump in Alaska, they talked about the potential for mutual cooperation. And President Putin, in particular, stressed the so-called frontier cooperation, so cooperating in the Arctic or cooperating in space. But nobody knows, but if, let's say, the U.S.-Russian relationship improves, do you think it would be in Moscow's interest to try to build, normal trade ties with the United States? Isn't it too risky to sort of try to enter into this, economic relationship with a power that changes its mind and strategy on you know, such a regular basis.
Absolutely. And the next president could repudiate the whole lot. And
within a week or within a couple of days, it doesn't even take the next president to do so. One person can do that.
At the moment, absolutely. Just a new wind from a different idea comes.
Absolutely.
The United States has proved an unreliable ally in the past, and not just for Russia, but for even its closest allies. And that is where the situation is we're facing today. But I would certainly love to see the Alaska agenda of economic cooperation developed, but it'd have to be done in equal partnership and with legal safeguards and so on. Of course, that was planned a good decade ago with Texaco and others, Arctic exploration, now Sahalin. So yes, there is.
It's remote enough, be it Arctic or space, to not affect everyday life. I guess that's also some of the hedging that the Kremlin is putting forth. They don't want to depend on the Americans in everyday circumstances, economic circumstances.
Yeah, absolutely. That's why it has to be genuine partnership and so on. But of course, you know, we can talk on the other side, the fact that to excessive reliance, perhaps on allies, India, China, is unequal. So in other words, Russia does need to, and all countries, I mean, even our dear United Kingdom, has to develop a more, localized, nationally focused industrial strategy. And this Labour government, for all of its faults, is beginning to do that. And that is, of course, this new phase in which we're moving. It's a post-globalisation, but even a globalisation was always a very strange phenomenon. And I think it was more of an ideological project. But it was reflecting this sort of liberal economic internationalism, open borders. But now protectionism, industrial strategy is back.
Now, that brings me to my, I guess, last question, and it's also about multipolarity. I wonder if we may witness the development of not so much a bipolar, but a bicameral system, when nations would have one set of rules, perhaps binding, mutual, with one set of partners, and something totally different with the West or with the United States.
So a more contingent set of relationships, depending on what the mood is in Washington or elsewhere.
Well, I mean, you have to adjust. That's the reality.
No, absolutely. I think that most countries would have to do that and probably do that anyway. What we do see, though, is the emergence of a more stable anti-hegemonic or counter-alignment going on. Russia, China as its core, India, as you say, a contingent partner, Vietnam and other countries as well, but imbued by the spirit of ASEAN, if you like. Even today, you know, the non-aligned movement is back. So I think that we're entering a new epoch of international politics, which, as I say, is not we're talking multi-order and indeed not necessarily chaos. So it's international anarchy does not necessarily mean chaos, and the world can manage its affairs without a hegemonic leadership, especially one so unreliable and moody as the one as the United States.
Can I ask something very quickly? Because you also mentioned in one of your articles that we are witnessing essentially the death of classical diplomacy, of old school diplomacy. Do you in fact believe that's the case? I mean, just because the United States and the West disregard it, does it mean that there is no interest in this way of, you know, building relationship among other nations?
Oh, absolutely. That, in other words, the best traditions of old-fashioned diplomacy, which the Europeans used to excel at, is now being handed over to, the so-called global south, the world majority. Absolutely. Whereas diplomatic relations, for example, just a few days ago, the European Union was very proudly saying that it managed to expel 750 Russian diplomats as the height of its diplomatic achievement. Now, at that point, you realize this is a totally bankrupt approach to international affairs.
Now, we have to leave it there. It's been a great honor for me to talk to you. Thank you very much for that.
My pleasure. Thank you.
And thank you for watching. Hope to see you again on Worlds Apart.